At the very end of the period.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to call to order the Senate Special Committee on Conduct. It is March 26, 2015. Colleagues, this is new for all of us, and so the first order of business is to adopt the committee bills. The committee
rules.
Rules. What did I say?
Bills.
Committee rules. Rick.
Thank you, Chair. I do have the committee rules that were sent to you in advance. Numbers 1 through 6 are your kind of boilerplate language rules that we use in a lot of committees that talk about a quorum being necessary. The chair setting the agenda open to the public. It does vary a little bit when we get down to 7 through 10. It does state that the special committee shall investigate complaints submitted relating to the conduct of a member or officer of the Senate, and the investigation must be within the nature and scope of the complaint. Does say that the committee shall make appropriate findings promptly to the full Senate. Does say that based upon the investigation, we have to report these findings within 45 days of receiving the complaint, and then a majority of appointing members shall be required to approve the recommendations. Thank you, Chair.
Chairwoman Sanderson, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated March 20th, 2015.
26.
Oh, 26, I'm sorry.
Okay. So Senator Winters moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated March 26, 2015. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? The motion passes and the rules are adopted. All right. The purpose of today's meeting is to review a complaint referred to the Special Committee on Conduct that was referred to this committee on March 23, 2015. And I'm going to ask our committee administrator to briefly describe the complaint. Rick?
Thank you, Chair. This complaint was actually drafted by William E. Currier and Tyler Smith on March 18, 2015. It's in regard to House Bill 3052 that received a public hearing before the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness on March 10, 2015. The complaint raised two issues. One being that alleges that Senator Chip Shields violated ORS 244-120 and Senate Rule 3.33, and these are in relations to members of the Legislative Assembly being required to announce an actual or potential conflict of interest before taking action. Second issue raised was that Senator Shields may have used state resources or state staff to assist in advocacy for this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. All right. Per Senate Rule 3.33, the committee's charge, what we're supposed to do is investigate the alleged violation and report to the full Senate. And the report has to contain a copy of the complaint, which all of you have, whether or not there was a violation of the Senate rule requiring a member to announce an actual or potential conflict of interest if one existed. And then we are to recommend sanctions, if any, and the basis for the committee's recommendation. So, any questions so far? If the committee recommends, it's also important to say if the committee recommends no action, then the complaint is considered dismissed. So, I would like to call up Senator Shields for his testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, and I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity today to respond to the complaint filed by the Oregon Republican Party. Oregon has a citizens' legislature where members work outside the legislature. Oftentimes, ideas for good public policy arise out of our real-world experiences. We have disclosure rules for those areas where a potential conflict arises. So what happened and how did we get here? In 2014, I began to see one of those real-world problems, namely that Oregon seemed to have very unclear requirements regarding use of environmentally acceptable lubricants in environmentally sensitive areas, like bridge construction or over our rivers and waterways. I felt that this lack of clarity could be putting our ecosystems at risk. I also learned through my job that hydraulic systems are notorious for leaks and blowouts, and that Oregon might want to explore using biodegradable lubricants to help stem pollution on Oregon Public Works lands. I brought the question to State Representative Lou Frederick. We both represent areas in contact with the polluted Portland Harbor Superfund site with the Columbia Slough, and we know the environmental challenges happening in the Rivergate industrial areas. As someone who has taken a keen interest in mitigating and in improving North and Northeast Portland's brownfields, polluted brownfields, Rep. Frederick liked the idea and was open to researching the topic with Legislative Council. He called Legislative Council, and Legislative Council confirmed that Oregon had virtually no standards for lubricant biodegradation in statute or rule. In February, close to the bill filing deadline, Representative Frederick and I talked, and he decided to draft a bill to get that conversation going. It made sense to me to see if the bill could fly on its own wings in the House of Representatives. That bill was HB 3052. The bill had a public hearing on March 10th where Representative Frederick said, quote, "The ideas behind this bill came from one of my constituents, who you know, Chip Shields. He works for a company that includes a product line of biodegradable lubricants. And since he has a conflict, he brought this idea to me to consider in the House. He helped me understand this issue and assemble my testimony a bit for today. The notion, Madam Chair, was to be transparent and go above and beyond what was required in disclosure rules. I'd like to take this opportunity, if I could, Madam Chair, to clarify some of the points that have been missing or were underreported by media accounts of this incident. Number one, this bill would be good for the Oregon environment. That was my motivation. Number two, there's nothing in this bill that gives my company a competitive advantage. The major lubricants companies in Oregon are Chevron, Shell, and Mobil. And as Representative Frederick said in his testimony, he said, quote, "Virtually all of the major and many minor lubricant manufacturers carry lines of biodegradable lubricants today, particularly in the hydraulic fluid product lines." And he also said that I will submit my prepared remarks for the record and include links to technical data sheets of Chevron Clarity, Mobil EAL, and Shell Natural. And we've enclosed those technical data sheets, posted them up to OLIS along with my testimony. So, Madam Chair, my employer and the company in which I am a shareholder sells biodegradables. They are 9 products of 300-plus products that we sell. However, many, many other companies also sell biodegradable lubricants. Those of you with laptops or cell phones, if you punch into your phone right now, biodegradable lubricants, you'll get thousands of hits. And an analogy might be this. Biodegradable lubricants are to lubricants what diet soda is to soda. Virtually everybody that sells lubricants also sells biodegradable lubricants, just like everybody that sells soda also sells diet soda. So there's nothing in this bill that would give my company a competitive advantage. We own no patents in our biodegradable line. This bill wouldn't drive people to us. We could not corner the market. The likely outcome of this bill passing would have been that the big construction companies, who generally use products made by the big lubricants companies, would continue with the same company that makes their other lubricants. In other words, a construction company that uses Shell mineral-based hydraulic fluid would likely ask their Shell distributor for the biodegradable version of Shell hydraulic fluid. Number three, one media outlet suggested I misled Representative Frederick and that somehow that has hurt our relationship. Nothing could be further from the truth. Representative Frederick does not believe I misled him, and he still supports the ideas behind this bill. Number four, another media outlet suggested that there was millions of dollars at stake, implying that I would make millions of dollars because of this bill. As mentioned, there is no competitive advantage to my company in this bill, and construction companies would likely stick with the brand name they were currently using. However, lubricants are a relatively minor part of public improvement projects. For my company, biodegradables are 9 products out of 300-plus product line that we sell. And if one excludes engine oil, as Representative Frederick suggested in his testimony, the state is mostly looking at hydraulic fluids. A typical hydraulic system has a capacity of 20 gallons of hydraulic fluid. 20 gallons of hydraulic fluid typically costs about $300 at $15 per gallon. Biodegradable hydraulic fluid can cost 20% more, but can save the company on the back end in reduced cleanup fines. It's important to know that hydraulic fluid lasts a very long time, a minimum of 3,000 hours, or if the piece of equipment is running full time, that's about 1.4 years on that 20 gallons that are in that hydraulic system. So if you piece that together and you take the $300 spread out over 1.4 years, you're looking at $214.29 per piece of mobile construction equipment for their hydraulic system annually. For conventional hydraulic fluid, mineral oil based, versus about $257.15 annually for biodegradable. So that $200-some-odd is real money, but it's not millions. And again, there's nothing in this bill that would give us a competitive advantage. The likely outcome is people will stick with the brand name they were already using rather than switching to our company. Number 5. Another media outlet implied that because my family members who are also involved in the company gave me campaign contributions, that they did so to push this legislation to benefit the company. I think I've shown that there's nothing in this bill that would give a competitive advantage to my company. And the fact is, my dad and my brother made contributions to my campaign because they wanted to support me. That's what dads and brothers do. That same media outlet suggested that the company could have hired a lobbyist to push the bill, but only sought to introduce such legislation after I took an active role in the company. So, Madam Chair, let me be clear. My company had nothing to do with this bill. They didn't ask for it. They didn't know I explained the ideas to Representative Frederick. And I'm proud of our company. In an age of massive offshoring, my company has kept its production here in the States. It's a family-owned company that has never sold out to the highest bidder, never sold out to Wall Street, never sold out to a private equity firm. It's a company I'm proud to work for. Regarding House Bill 3052, I'm not pursuing the bill. I know intentions are hard to prove, and the public is weary of guessing the motives of politicians. There's no way to prove a negative or to prove what my intentions were. I can only reiterate that my motivation was to start a conversation about better protecting Oregon's environment on public works lands. Madam Chair, committee members, I thank you for taking the time to consider my testimony.
Thank you, Senator Shields. I appreciate that testimony, and I would like to open it up to the committee to see if you have any questions for Senator Shields. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Senator, for your testimony. I'm curious about one thing, if I may. In your testimony and what you've written here, and I quote, "I can only reiterate that my motivation was to start a conversation about better protecting Oregon's environment on public works land." Having said that, to start the conversation, my question is, why didn't you make it a Senate bill to begin with?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, I just felt that it would be a little more arm's length, and that if the bill couldn't fly on its own wings in the House, then it didn't deserve to be in the body that I participated in.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Just a question. Did you testify on the bill over in the House?
I did not.
May I ask one
please.
Do you frequently do that? As a senator, start bills in the House?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, no, I've not done that, I don't think.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Senator Shields. And colleagues, I've asked Legislative Counsel Dexter Johnson to review the alleged complaints for his legal opinion on the matter, which is on OLUS. correct committee administrator. It's on OLS. Okay. And I would like to call up Mr. Johnson to walk the committee through the opinion that he has drafted for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. Madam Chair, you asked me to review the complaint filed on March 18th of this year, and I've done so, and I'd be happy to discuss my findings. Essentially, the complaint raises two issues. The complaint alleges that Senator Shields did not comply with the conflict of interest rules that you were all subject to, first. And second, the complaint also alleges that Senator Shields violated ethics laws by using state staff and resources in a way that ethics laws prohibit. I'll address both of these issues, but I'll address them separately. And first turn to the conflict of interest issue. A conflict of interest, essentially, there are two kinds, but for purposes of legislators, they essentially, the rules are the same, whether it is an actual conflict or a potential conflict. And in either case, it is a conflict of interest arises when a legislator or a relative or business with which the legislature is associated stands to benefit financially or avoid a financial detriment as a result of the passage of legislation. Under chamber rules and statutes, when a conflict of interest arises, the legislator has a duty to declare that a conflict of interest exists and to state the nature of that conflict at the time that the legislator is required to act. And acting in this context means taking a vote, either in committee, and a committee that the legislator serves on, or when the bill comes before the entire chamber in a floor session, just prior to taking a vote on the floor of the legislature, of the senator or house. I concluded that there's no conflict of interest here because House Bill 3052 is in a House committee, a committee that Senator Shields does not serve on, and therefore would not be in a position to act. Senator Shields would not be able to vote on a bill in the House committee that the bill is in. And House Bill 3052 has remained in that committee. It has never appeared on the Senate floor, and therefore Senator Shields would not have the capacity to act in a floor vote either on that. So I conclude that there's no conflict of interest violation of the duties that that Senator Shields has to declare a conflict of interest. He only needs to do that in advance of voting, and he did not have an opportunity to vote on this measure. I also conclude that even if he had that opportunity, there is an exception to the conflict of interest rules called the class exception. And that exception arises when the measure under consideration would affect a group of individuals or entities in exactly the same way. And in this case, the House Bill 3052 affects manufacturers of biodegradable lubricants. There is a number of companies that are engaged in that business, of which the firm that Senator Shields is associated with is only one. And the bill would affect all participants in that business equally. And so, therefore, that the conditions for a class exist, and the class exception would actually obviate the need for Senator Shields to declare a conflict of interest had he been in a position to vote on the bill. So, one, there was no conflict because he never was in a position to vote on the bill, and two, even if he had been, the class exception would have resulted in him not needing to declare the conflict in advance of voting. That's my analysis of the first issue. Would members have questions about that, or should I turn directly to the second issue?
Well, just one question. So a person can introduce a bill that's related to his own employment, and I know that that's probably done a lot within the body, but there's no conflict, is what you're saying, unless that member takes a vote.
Chair Montes-Anderson, that's correct. There's no requirement of declaring a conflict when you merely introduce a bill.
So we could introduce bills and that may be in conflict, but there's nothing in the rule that says that that's an ethics, that that violates this rule.
And Chairman Montes-Anderson, yeah, that's correct.
I just want to make sure I was clear. Yes, Senator Hansel.
Just a question that I would have. I don't know if you looked at it or not, but if you have, you know, the biodegradable, I mean, if you have the lubricant industry, is there anything that we should consider that if in passing a law like biodegradables, you could well or move out of the competition pool those that have lubricants but don't have biodegradable lubricants, and therefore create a more competitive advantage for companies that do offer that? I'm just curious if that's a consideration, or if it even exists, or do you follow what I'm saying here, that while you still have a class of biodegradables, you've eliminated anybody that may not have that but currently market for that type of?
Chair Montes-Anderson, Senator Hansel, I think I understand the nature of your question, which is, could you require in the bill that there be that those who are in one group have some type of competitive advantage be considered one way, and those that don't be considered another way? Is that the essence?
No, the essence is that you've got company A, B, C, D, you know, A through Z, let's say, that currently provide hydraulic fluid. Of that, A through J don't have biodegradables. So when you pass a bill that would require the state to use biodegradables, are you not in fact creating an advantage for your company that provides biodegradables, or any company that provides biodegradables, by eliminating from the competition those that don't?
Senator Hansel, I think the Legislative Assembly is free to make policy choices and could make a policy choice to benefit biodegradable lubricant manufacturers versus other manufacturers. That is within the sphere of policy choices that the legislature is in fact designed to address.
Colleagues, we're not supposed to go beyond 10:30, but
I just a quick question. Should the bill advanced to the Senate, from the House and then came to the Senate, then would Senator Shields be obligated then to actually state a conflict of interest?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Winters, my conclusion is no. Again, there is, if the bill had advanced to the Senate floor, out of an abundance of caution, he might prudently declare that conflict of interest. But actually, the class exception, my conclusion is that the class exception would apply here, and he, in fact, legally is not required to declare a conflict of interest because the bill benefits a group of biodegradable lubricant manufacturers equally, and that's sufficient to be a class.
You know, we're posing this because often we all stand and say in the abundance of caution, an example, you know, even when it involves a relative, for example, when my son was, you know, a Ford dealer, then whenever anything that came up to deal with the automobile industry, you know, I would declare just to make certain that we aren't really, because it's a family member that benefits even though I don't benefit. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, we have, I think most of us do, declare that conflict, even just for the, whether it's the letter, it's of the law, it is actually the appearance, and we want to make certain that the public and others know that we are being transparent. So I guess that's why I asked that question.
Yes, Senator Winters, it is often prudent to do so, particularly when you consider the appearance issue, but that is not a legal issue. Legally, you are not required to if there's a reasonably identifiable class that benefits equally under the measure being considered.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like clarification on, so there's the requirement to declare an actual or public, an actual or potential conflict of interest. Is there a prohibition on having an actual conflict of interest in the law?
Yeah. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Edwards, no. There is for many public officials, but not for legislators. You are, and in fact, there is, under chamber rules, you are not allowed to abstain from voting. And so you must vote, even if you have an actual conflict of interest. And the only action you can take and are required to take is to declare that conflict of interest before voting.
Okay. We have a choice. We can recess, since it's going to be a very short floor session for us, recess until after floor session's over and then come right back. Senator.
Madam Chair, I've got a guest that's really looking forward to sitting on the floor. I would prefer to come back if that's possible.
It's fine. Okay. All right. So we are in recess until after floor session. So I am going to reconvene a work session of the Senate Special Committee on Conduct. And we had Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council, if he would come up. And he has covered issue one, and now he will start talking about issue two of the complaint.
Thank you,
investigation.
Chairman Anderson, members. Again, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, for the record. So touching base, moving on to issue two, the complaint also raised the, in the second issue, that senators alleged that Senator Shields violated the state's ethics laws by using state staff and resources to prepare for and advocate on behalf of House Bill 3052. And we looked at that issue and concluded that regardless of the facts involved, there could not have been a violation of state ethics laws on those grounds. And indeed, we concluded that really a primary purpose of a state legislator is to advocate on behalf of measure that is before the Legislative Assembly in which they believe the legislature should enact it. And to that end, they are completely entitled to use state staff and resources to best present their case. There are, when there are circumstances are such that a legislator stands to benefit financially from the measure in question, the remedy is to declare a conflict of interest and state the nature of that conflict of interest on the record prior to voting, either in committee or on the floor. And as we discussed previously, one, that those circumstances did not arise in the context of this bill, and two, had they, Senator Shields would have been able to rely on the class exception in any event. But setting that aside, there's no other ethics law violated by Senator Shields using staff or state resources to prepare for and advocate on behalf of a bill in which he believed in.
Thank you very much. All right. I know that Senator Edwards had a question.
I do.
Not necessarily on the complaint, but in...
Well, it's the questions I have, Dexter, are about the underlying law. So so you referenced earlier that we are required, legislators are required to vote on issues. I mean, other than not being there, but I mean, if you're there, you cannot abstain from a vote. You can't recuse yourself from a vote. Where does that come from?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Edwards, that is a function of the chamber rules as an initial matter. And I would have to look at this a little bit more closely, but I believe it's actually grounded in the Constitution itself.
Okay, so follow up.
Yes.
So the reason I ask is because it seems to me that legislators, well, you could have an actual conflict or a potential conflict, and if you could have an actual conflict or a potential conflict, which may be created either by action that a legislator took or completely unbeknownst to them, somebody else drafted a bill that happens to affect them, and they're part of a smaller, you know, they're not a part of a larger class, and it seems like they would be caught, they have no way out of the vote. I mean, they have to vote on it, and so the only thing they can do is, and are obligated to do, is to declare that conflict or potential conflict. And so I guess what I'm wondering is if there were a statutory change to, you know, to the underlying law, if there were a statutory change that said you cannot have a conflict, would it be constitutional to then also attach to that an ability to recuse yourself from the vote? Mm.
Senator Edwards, I believe the principle of requiring a declaration of conflict of interest is entirely a statutory matter. So the legislature could choose to simply not have those conflict of interest rules apply to legislators. The question about whether you must cast a vote or not is, again, this is something I would want to look at much more closely before answering definitively, but I believe it is based on the principle that a measure requires, unless it's a supermajority, it requires a simple majority vote, but it must be of the entire body, not of those present. And so you can get a situation where you have a quorum, but and a majority of those present voting, but that's not a majority of the body. And the Constitution, I believe, is principles developed under that preclude the legislature from allowing that situation to actually arise.
Okay, so follow up. So I'm trying to understand it. Okay, so I guess, Madam Chair, I'm thinking through why it is the underlying statute allows for conflicts to exist. And it seems to me that the underlying statute allows for a conflict to exist because there's no way to get out of a vote if you're voting in, I mean, if the legislator is in a conflicted situation. Does that make sense?
Senator Edwards, I think it does in the sense of why does the, your question is why does the statute require a declaration before voting?
Yeah.
Yes, and that is the only remedy that is available to you as a legislator when you are faced with a situation where you have either an actual conflict, that is to say, you are going to, you or a relative or a business is going to definitely stand to benefit financially or avoid a financial detriment, or a potential conflict where that potential is there but it is not certain. And in both of those situations, the only remedy that a legislator has is to declare the conflict, state the nature of it before voting.
Dexter, what it doesn't do, I asked the question, where you have a situation like in this situation where the individual is the senator who actually is in conversation with the individual over in the House, and so therefore they would not have voted in the House until it came over to this this body, and yet they were involved in the, probably in actually helping to craft the language, even though one other came to your office to get it done. And I think some of our concern is looking at, you know, we've been in here, and I think we're all struggling with how do we make certain that we, as this body legislatively, can conduct our business, you know, declare our declaration, and still at the same time be as transparent as we can with the public in situations like this one. I think that, you know, given what has happened in the executive branch of government, we want to make certain that the legislative branch of government is not being accused of or implied in using our positions with undue influence. So I think that really is where we're grappling. At least that's that's me, to make certain that we are as transparent in this body as possible, and that our statutes and rules reflect that.
Senator Hansel.
Dexter, I'm wondering, too, if perhaps that what we're talking about here is really embedded more in Mason's rules of order. That's how we conduct business, as opposed to Robert's rules of order. Because I know under conducting business, under Robert's rules of order, you can abstain, you can defer, you can do these things. So I think by adopting as a body Mason's rules, it precludes, and that's where the conflict is, you have to vote, you can't. And I think that might be where it's embedded as opposed to the Constitution. I could be wrong, but I believe it's the rules we adopt through the general legislative rules of order, which are otherwise known as Mason's. I could be wrong, but I think that might be a possibility, too.
Senator Moniz-Anderson, Senator Hansel, yes, that it definitely, the explicit requirement that you may not abstain is a function of either chamber rules or Mason's rules. Either of those, you are, as a legislative body, as a chamber, entitled to modify. The constitutional principle that this may ultimately be grounded on, of course, would be much more complex to modify.
Yes. All right. I would like to let's focus on the findings that we have now, and from what Mr. Johnson has provided us, he had on issue one that Senator Shields' failure to declare a conflict of interest during the public hearing for House Bill 3052 did not violate ORS 244.120 or Senate Rule 3.33. And he's gone through good information that lets us know that. And then on issue two, Senator Shields did not violate the law by using state resources or state staff to draft or promote House Bill 3052. And what I would like is a motion that we accept Legislative Council's findings. And
Madam Chair, I move the committee recommend.
No.
I move that we accept the findings of the Legislative Council.
So Senator Winters moves that we accept the findings from Legislative Council. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Edwards?
Yes.
Senator Hansel?
Yes.
Senator Winters?
Yes.
Chair Ramos Anderson?
Aye. We have accepted the findings. Now, we have summarized, and what we need to do now is seek, since there's no merit to the alleged violation, I see no, I would like the committee to please let me know if they accept the, that you said you have accepted the findings, so we have not seen any reason to pursue this any further. Is that correct? Yes.
Madam Chair, I appreciate Senator Edwards' questions and whatnot. I think it's pretty clear the rules have been adopted and how, you know, there isn't there. I also agree with Senator Winters, who said that in light of everything that's going on, you know, it's of concern that, but I think the rules are pretty clear, and until we adopt some differences, if we choose to do so, it's pretty clear, and I think the matter is over.
And I think that we need to, the Oregon Republican Party did send, I think each one of you has a copy that they, but this is something for rules, not something for this committee, that they wanted to put an end to public officials using their offices to create taxpayer-funded programs that enrich that official's friends and family. But that's something I think that if this is going to happen would go into as a something that would be accepted by the...
Madam Chair,
I think for this particular item on our agenda that we actually proceed and complete it. And then I think that we could always recommend two rules that they look at this particular issue, because I do think we all are concerned to make certain that the work that we do legislatively, that not just the rule and abiding by it, but if there is some areas in that rule that we can actually make it better, I think all of us, you know, are wanting to make certain that we clarify any gray areas that may exist. So I would recommend that we go ahead and proceed with our charge at hand today, which is, but that we also then recommend that perhaps we give this to, and I think somebody's here from Senate President's office to, that, yes, that we may want to ask that the Senate President begin to look at this particular issue as well.
Okay. So since I note that there's no merit to alleged violation, there's no need for committee recommendation, and so this report is going to be submitted to the Secretary of the Senate within 3 session days of the final committee action. Yes, Rick.
Chair, and it'll probably be in a summary format, still capturing the findings of the opinion, but in a more summation.
Right, and I think I did report. I did put on the record issue 1 and issue 2 where there were no findings found. Okay?
Okay.
May I have just a procedural? All the documents that we have, do we keep them? Do we? They're public documents, I take it.
They're up on the OLIS. Yeah.
They're on OLIS.
But Madam Chair, just part of the procedure, I know that we completed with the task at hand. Will you actually have some conversation with the Senate President,
yes,
with respect to the concerns of this committee that we would either, he can either, you know, give it to rules or maybe create a work group that will further look at what's feasible for us to do going forward in the future.
All right. I am going to close the work session, and I am going to adjourn the hearing. Thank you very much, committee. Thank you very much, committee.